This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best of NPR's arts and culture stories. I am Neda Ulaby, NPR arts reporter.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
You can, as always, subscribe to this very podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
Tyler Perry, the actor and producer behind the Madea franchise, changes course towards art films.
Rock band OK Go breaks ties with their record label over a music video on YouTube.
And we look at the value of ebooks. But first,
you might have noticed a recent trend on the screen. The Hurt Locker, about a bomb squad in Iraq, won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Green Zone, a thriller set in war-torn Baghdad, opened in theaters last week. And this past Sunday, HBO began their 10-part World War II miniseries called The Pacific. In case you had any doubt, the war movie is back. Bob Mandello has the story.
2 years ago, war flicks had Hollywood feeling pretty embattled. The combined star power of Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford couldn't make Lions for Lambs roar at the box office. The public barely noticed when Tommy Lee Jones got lost in the Valley of Ella, and Redacted, Stop Loss, and Rendition were all on DVD before audiences quite realized that they had been in theaters. And since then, Hollywood's greenlighted so many new Iraq flicks that this year you could trace the war's whole history at the Oscars. Best Original Screenplay nominee In the Loop showed comic bureaucrats getting us into a Middle Eastern conflict.
12,000?
That's the amount that are going to die. And at the end of a war, you need some soldiers left, really, or else it looks like you've lost.
Then Best Picture winner, The Hurt Locker, gave us war's adrenaline rush.
Why is Eldridge running?
Drop the phone!
Hey, Barry!
I can't get a shot!
And in The Messenger, supporting actor nominee Woody Harrelson brought home the aftermath of war by delivering sad news to soldiers next of kin.
You never want to park too close. They hear a car park, go to the window, see two soldiers getting out. It's just a minute of torture.
Despite the year-end honors, none of these films caused much shock and awe at the box office, but by compartmentalizing, by focusing narrowly on personal stories within the Iraq conflict rather than being conventional battle strategy movies, they did suggest a change in Hollywood's battle strategy. Today's premiere of the $100 million action flick, Green Zone, will test how far that strategy can take a film commercially. Green Zone stars Matt Damon as a soldier racing around Baghdad in 2003 looking for the weapons of mass destruction that were the Bush administration's chief argument for going to war.
Use the book and trade up and get some help.
What are you talking about?
Jerry, why the do we keep coming up empty on all these sites? There has got to be a reason.
Chief, we're here to do a job and get home safe. That's all. The reasons don't matter.
They matter to me.
Director Paul Greengrass and his Bourne conspiracy team don't really care if they matter to the audience, as long as everyone gets caught up in the suspense. Green Zone is essentially a series of frantic chase sequences, a Bourne movie with an Iraqi accent. This action flick approach is designed to avoid the ideological divide that has made the Iraq War, and before it the war in Vietnam, so hard to handle cinematically, at least until everyone comes home. If Green Zone works and audiences rent Hurt Locker because of its big Oscar win, Hollywood may just have figured this one out. HBO, on the other hand, has chosen to fight a different and dramatically a safer war in its 10-part series, The Pacific, following a group of Marines from Guadalcanal to the end of their service in World War II.
When we move, do not stop. The entire division's moving across the airfield.
With 10 hours to establish characters and a whole different narrative rhythm, The Pacific resembles in its breadth and sweep the sort of old-fashioned war epic Hollywood used to do on the big screen, filled with maps and mud and harrowing reenactments of battles that turned the tide. Though it centers on the true stories of a few Marines, it's designed to tell the story of tens of thousands of their comrades, much as did the 1980s miniseries Winds of War and War and Remembrance and 2001's Band of Brothers.
History is full of wars fought for 100 reasons.
Look at that.
But this war, our war, I want to believe, I have to believe that it's all worthwhile because our cause is just.
The sureness of that sentiment regarding perhaps the last war where right and wrong seemed absolutely clear gives this World War II story a force that portraits of contemporary conflicts are bound to have trouble matching. The Pacific is not without nuance. American troops are shown behaving savagely at times in ways no one could be proud of. In an Iraq war movie, that would almost certainly be read as an indictment of the military. But at a remove of more than half a century, it seems more about war itself, what war's brutality does to individuals. Too much of that sort of nuance might well prove fatal to an action movie like Green Zone, but somehow it doesn't dampen the Pacific's impact. The immediacy of battle is what war movies always promise, but distance has its advantages. I'm Bob Mandela.
Well, war movies may be back, but they're certainly not the only movies out there. Tyler Perry is a tall, handsome guy who's written, directed, and starred in half a dozen hit movies, mostly centering on women. But he became a star playing a foul-mouthed grandma with a gun.
I ain't scared of no popo car, the popo hawk car, the popo.
On stage and screen, Madea made Perry into one of the biggest names in black entertainment. But Netta, you said in a piece that you did recently that Perry is spinning his popular success into an opportunity to tell more serious stories. Let's start by taking a listen to that story.
Tyler Perry, Triple Threat, makes hit movies, TV shows, and plays about fractious families.
Hell to the no, this is blasphemy. My daddy was a saint.
Your daddy was a pimp.
About women in romantic distress.
For goodness sake, you see a man touching all over me, and you do nothing about it. You call yourself a husband. You are a punk.
And when he's not producing two successful cable TV shows, Perry is not afraid to put on a dress and stomp around playing Medea, a grandma who literally praises the Lord and passes the ammunition.
You see, when I got saved, thank you. I mean, when I saved the rest of them bullets.
Perry clearly gets an enormous kick out of playing his signature character, a rowdy old hellraiser who thumps kids when they're sassy, when she's not threatening to shank them. Tyler Perry admits his work is not exactly highbrow.
What people forget, because I'm often criticized because the movies are so predictable and so simple, I'm writing for 2-year-olds to 90-year-olds. My fan base is so broad, so I tell a simple story on purpose.
Perry's stories rely on a blend of faith and comedy to appeal to a largely female, largely Christian audience who've transformed this former high school dropout into one of the entertainment world's most formidable new figures. But the criticism he's received has been harsh. Filmmaker Spike Lee used racially loaded words to describe Perry's TV shows, coonery and buffoonery. Melvin Peters is a professor of African American literature, and he says Spike Lee has a point.
When you look at those shows, buffoonery comes into it. Black woman slapping the man upside the head, telling jokes about the crackhead woman character.
Next time you on crack, pick me up one of those $20 Rolexes.
You're on perilous ground when you present these things as humorous, you know? I mean, what crack has done to the African American community, African American women in particular? These are troubling things, you know.
But Perry says he is passionate about telling women's stories. It's always been the basis of his artistic drive, as well as the source of his financial success. Still, Perry's approach to women's stories has recently diversified, dramatically.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine.
The movie Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, could not be more different from Tyler Perry's previous projects. Precious grapples with social problems seriously. It's artsy, disturbing, and new for Perry, critically acclaimed. But what attracted Tyler Perry to the film was his identification with the main character, an obese, illiterate teenage girl abused by her mother, played by the actress Monique.
So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me?
You know, my mother was my protector growing up because I was in a house like the one in Precious, and my father was Monique's character. So she would take me everywhere with her to protect me. So I went to hair salons, and I went to the Lane Bryant, and I would listen to all these women, you know, a little boy listening to all this. I soaked up everything. So a lot of times when I'm writing, I'm thinking about those women and those experiences.
Tyler Perry's used those experiences for his movies, TV shows, and plays throughout his entire career. He says Medea comes from the same place as Precious. She's based on real women who have also been his intended audience. Now, though, Perry wants his stories about women to have a broader reach.
I've kind of painted myself in a box with the Tyler Perry brand.
While he's not going to abandon Medea, Perry says he'll soon retire her for a while.
It's very risky. It's very risky on so many levels. That's why I started this other company to do these types of films.
Perry has essentially started an art house division called 34th Street Productions. It's named for Miracle on 34th Street because Perry says his life is a miracle. In his 20s, he lived in his car while writing a musical that eventually found a following in the black theater circuit. Now, not two decades later, Perry owns a massive movie studio in Atlanta. There, he's now filming an adaptation of a play that embodies the revolutionary thrill of black feminism and identity politics in the 1970s.
My spirit is too ancient to understand the separation of soul and gender. My love is too delicate to have thrown back in my face.
Written by playwright Ntozake Shange, for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough, ran on Broadway and was earlier filmed for public television.
My love is too beautiful to have thrown back on my face.
All right, y'all.
My love is too take it to the bridge to have thrown back on my face.
For colored girls is a staple of black literature courses, like the ones taught by Professor Melvin Peters.
Ntozake Shange is a writer of great intelligence and great stature, and her work is classic.
The play lyrically delves into different aspects of black womanhood through a chorus of seven actresses, colorfully identified as the Lady in Red, the Lady in Yellow, the Lady in Blue.
Orange butterflies and aqua sequins and sconce dream slight bosoms. Silk roses darting from behind my ears. The passion flower of southwest Los Angeles. Meanders down Hoover Street.
You know, the story was so rich, and I didn't know, because it was written, you know, when I was born, and I didn't know how powerful and how amazing it was.
In fact, Tyler Perry did not particularly care about For Colored Girls. It was acquired by a member of his staff, and for a while, he says, it was nothing but a problem.
We were kept giving notes and couldn't get the script right, and we couldn't figure it out. So I finally started paying attention to it, and I was like, wait a minute, whoa, this stuff is great.
The notion of Medea directing for colored girls shocked some black intellectuals. Tyler Perry does not blame them.
I'm shocked, too. I think they have every right to be shocked. And I've even seen outrage. How dare you touch this? We don't want this to be this way. But rest assured, there'll be no Medea in the movie. And they can also rest assured that I'm going to stay very true to what Ntozake's done.
And maybe Tyler Perry can help guide the play to a new generation of young women, says African-American literature professor Melvin Peters.
As long as he doesn't play one of the roles.
Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls began filming last fall. He's scripting, directing, and producing it. Perry's been cagey about the cast, but it's rumored to include friends like Oprah Winfrey and Jill Scott. The movie is scheduled for release next year. Tyler Perry's latest romantic drama, Why Did I Get Married 2, will be in theaters next month. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
So, Linda, when I did that piece, it was at the Toronto Film Festival. I went down. It was part of the Junket for Precious. And my editor had been following the controversy about Tyler Perry directing for Colored Girls, and she said, you know, you've got to talk to him about this decision. And a lot of times people are very focused on just promoting whatever they're there to do. He was so happy to talk about For Colored Girls. He could have talked about For Colored Girls all day long. But he was super serious about it. I was kind of joking with him, trying to get him to crack a smile. The only time he laughed was when he was talking about how much criticism he was getting from people.
Interesting.
Then he was just like, he just started laughing.
Yeah, very interesting.
On to another side of the economics of the entertainment business. Is a rock video on the internet free advertising, or is it just giving away the store? For the rock band OK Go, these questions became so incredibly contentious they decided to break ties with their record label, EMI. You might have seen OK Go's adorable, inventive music videos like the ones they made with what are they called? Exercise machines?
The treadmills.
Treadmills, right. They've been huge viral hits on YouTube, but before their most recent record came out, EMI told YouTube to stop letting people embed their video for OK Go's latest single, This Too Shall Pass.
Where the money goes.
Robert Siegel spoke with OK Go's singer and songwriter Damian Kulash about the fallout with their label and asked him how they view creating a video for which nobody makes any money.
This is all sort of part of the creative project for us. I mean, the animating passion for us is to get up and chase down our craziest ideas. And sometimes those are filmic and sometimes are purely sounds. The videos for us have always been a creative outlet. And when the industry saw them as advertisements a few years ago, it was really easy for us because they were happy for us to distribute these things wherever. But now, of course, the industry needs to find revenue everywhere because it's shrinking so fast, and so they need to see these as creative products now.
They want to get paid for people looking at the video of the song that, in theory at least, they've invested in.
Exactly, and you can't really blame them. I mean, they put a lot of investment into bands, and in fact, there's a good reason for that. It's because about one out of 20 bands that even gets to the level of being on a major label really succeeds. So they've got to pay for the other 19 somehow.
Now, let me just say that there are two videos that you produced for This Too Shall Pass. The Rube Goldberg is phenomenal, and if people haven't seen it yet, they should. There's another one that involves the Notre Dame Marching Band, which is also terrific. They're both out there, and I gather the label had said one of them can be embedded, but not the other.
Yeah, we made the Notre Dame version of the video about 3 months ago, and we put that one up, and following the label's sort of standard procedure at that time, it wasn't embeddable. And we just got a lot of response from our fans, people really upset that they couldn't put it on their sites, and they couldn't blog about it, and they couldn't sort of include it in their internet. It had to be done the way EMI wanted them to. So before we made our next video, we looked for corporate sponsorship, which would allow us to roll out the video the way we wanted to. And to be fair, EMI helped us find corporate sponsors, who turned out to be State Farm. State Farm agreed to cover the cost of the video if we would thank them at the end of it, and they left the creativity entirely to us. And it was sort of, it's kind of like, you know, 17th century patronage of the arts. We got to do what we wanted to do, and that we put a thank you on the end, and that's it.
Is it an amicable parting with EMI?
Unbelievably, it is a very amicable parting. The metric of success that the label uses is record sales, and specifically physical record sales. Our fans almost all buy our record online, and a lot of what we make has nothing to do with record sales. So we sort of are headed off in a direction that makes more sense for our band, and I think the label is, frankly, happy to watch us go and be successful doing our thing and not have to sort of fit into their box.
I want you to tell us a little bit about the making of the Rube Goldberg video for This Too Shall Pass. How many takes did it take you to get this whole thing done in a complete take?
It took us just over 60 takes, but we only counted a take as a take if it got significantly into the machine, because the machine starts with some dominoes and then a table with ball bearings rolling on it, and those were so incredibly flaky that I'd say the success rate of getting to that point was probably 40% or something, so we just threw away all those takes and didn't even count them.
I guess the secret of making a Rube Goldberg machine is to put some really flaky stuff at the beginning so you don't have to go through the whole machine and have it break down when you're 2 minutes into it.
Yes, the machine was designed definitely to get more and more stable as it went. And, you know, we designed the machine with initially about 15 people from a group called Sin Labs in Los Angeles. And by the end of the project, it was up to about 60 engineers. And these are people who have day jobs at NASA and Jet Propulsion Labs. And the guy who designed the most recent Coke bottle was one of the set painters. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing group of people, and everyone really working out of a labor of love. If we'd tried to do this the standard way you do a rock video, which is to hire out, you know, the best people you can get and then pay them what they're worth, this would have been a $10 million video at least.
So now that OK Go has left EMI and you're your own record label, Paracadute, what are you going to complain about all the time?
Hopefully there won't be that much to complain about. We see this as such a big opportunity. Everybody looks at the sort of shrinking of the industry as this horrible, horrible thing because nobody knows where to make money. But it's also the dissolution of a whole bunch of creative barriers. Now we sort of get to make whatever we want. And we've had good luck so far in being able to pay our rents with that.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
And I will say, Netta, that I fully agree with Robert Siegel, not only about the awesomeness of the Rube Goldberg video, but, you know, I would also encourage folks, if you're interested in it, once you see it, there are some really, really cool making of videos where you can sort of see what they were doing and you can see them building it. And they talk quite a bit about, you know, using real things. And, you know, the band guys brought in their friends and one of their dads. And it's very, very cool stuff.
Very cool.
And we will stay in the area of evolving industries and electronic content and move on to books. What a book is worth used to be fairly simple to calculate. There's the author's fee, printing, shipping, marketing. Calculating the right price for an electronic book is a little different, and consumers tend to think ebooks should be cheaper because they cost less to produce. But publishers are afraid that if the price goes too low, it will put them out of business. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Ebooks, says Jason Epstein, are on the verge of utterly transforming publishing, a business he has worked in for more than half a century.
It is the most exciting event, for as books are concerned, in 500 years.
Epstein, a well-known editor, publisher, and author, is a fixture in the book business. Writing about the future of publishing in the New York Review of Books, Epstein noted that many publishers fear ebooks will make them obsolete.
There'll be no inventory. There'll simply be digital files, and they'll be available worldwide at the click of a mouse. This makes much of what publishers now do irrelevant. Creating inventory, putting it in a warehouse, keeping track of it, selling it, shipping it, all that's going to go.
But Epstein says even given all those changes, it's a mistake to assume that at this point an e-book should necessarily cost less than the printed version of a book.
There's a serious misunderstanding there because the publishing companies do today exist and they do have all that overhead and they have to pay for it. And so that has to be figured into the cost of an electronic book. It's not just the cost of transmitting a file. So it's misleading to think that just because there's no physical book that the costs all disappear. They don't.
Ebooks may be getting all the attention in publishing these days, but that belies the fact that they remain a small fraction of the market. And that, says James McQuivey, an analyst with Forrester Research, is why publishing is in such a tough place right now. A revolution may be underway, but it's by no means complete.
The problem publishers face is that they're organized around analog economics, you know, that are decades, if not centuries old. And so from their perspective, cheaper books threaten that.
McQuivey says publishers know they can't stop the revolution, but they do want to slow it down, and maintaining a higher price for digital books is one way of doing that. They were frustrated when Amazon set the price for ebooks at $9.99. So when Apple unveiled the iPad with its ebook reader, they seized the opportunity to make prices more competitive. Now, most of the major publishing houses have negotiated a higher price for newly released ebooks. McQuivey says publishers are trying to inhibit the sale of ebooks by artificially inflating prices, which he believes is a mistake.
The pricing genie is already out of that bottle because if you go to Costco, you go to Walmart or Amazon.com, you're going to find hardback books that have been available for 2 weeks that are on sale for $12 and $14 in hardback. How can you explain to a customer that they should pay the same price for a digital edition? It just doesn't make sense.
One person who certainly doesn't see the sense in higher ebook prices is 25-year-old Chris Dannon. A freelance writer who specializes in technology, Dannon makes the argument that ebooks should be dirt cheap. Dannon believes publishers can trim a lot of fat from their budgets right now, cutting back on expenses like marketing, for example. Dannon is sympathetic to publishing's dilemma, but he says they need to leave their old business model behind.
They should be pushing for people to convert to the new medium. They can do whatever they want to support the old medium, the printed medium, but they have to get people used to the idea of buying and reading electronically simply because that's more profitable.
Dannon says publishers should be finding ways to make it easier, not harder, to buy electronic books.
If you're able to get your books in front of more people, which you can when they're electronically distributed, right? If you have iTunes selling your books, you have this entire store right on everyone's desktop, and you can expose them to a lot more. You can just get them into the habit of buying books. And more importantly, you make the process of buying completely frictionless. I mean, when you buy something on Amazon, you have that one-click purchase power.
But Jason Epstein warns the old and the new ways of getting a book to market will be competing with each other for the foreseeable future, and publishers are not yet in a position to abandon their old ways of doing business altogether.
One thing that publishers do have to consider in thinking of pricing is that they don't want to liquidate their existing retail structure by making it so inexpensive to get an e-book that people won't go to bookstores at all. And then publishers will have no place to sell the 90% of the books that they do create in the physical form.
It's too soon for questions like pricing to settle down, says Epstein, but they will eventually. And once things do settle down, Epstein predicts a future for publishing that looks not unlike the past, when a small team of editors helped shepherd a writer's book to market with relatively little interference from management. And that, says Chris Dannon, is the promise of digital publishing for young writers like himself. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
What I like about this piece is that there's a nice balance between sort of different points of view about print and electronic publishing, because a lot of times when you get these debates, you get sort of on the one hand, the print is for dinosaurs, paper is dead. You get that argument versus the sort of you can't hug a Kindle, paper books smell like wisdom. And though it kind of becomes a kind of war between things that really don't have anything to do with each other in a practical sense. And as I've discussed in the past, I am a Kindle owner. I'm an ebook reader. And
your Kindle has been smelling like Twilight recently.
My Kindle has been smelling like Twilight. That's right. We were talking on the blog earlier last week about the trailer for the next Twilight movie. And in the comments, we got into a conversation where we actually had several readers who sort of said, I've always kind of been curious about those books. I've never read them. And proposed that we sort of decide to read them together, all of us, the blog community, as it were. You
know. And there's a name to this book club that is...
There is. We are calling it the I Will If You Will book club.
But you sort of have to be egged on.
A little bit. Yeah. You have to be. I certainly did.
Or egged down. That's
exactly right. And so we're, you know, and I set out some guidelines. I think if you're going to read it, you got to give the book a chance. You got to be willing to read it and try to understand why people like it and not be just reading it so you can, you know, hate all over it. Although there's a little bit of that going on, too.
Any particularly choice comments you'd...
Yeah, my favorite so far was a tweet that we got from a user. One of them, the guy said, let's see, this guy, he's aloof, his eyes change color, he eats weird food, he watches you sleep, he says he loves you, and then he bares his teeth. It's a cat. So this is our analysis of Twilight, and it's ongoing, so.
Well, we're going to move for our final piece of the podcast to a sad story. Last week, Mark Linkous, founder of the acclaimed alternative rock band Sparkle Horse, died. The singer and multi-instrumentalist was known for his collaborations with Tom Waits, PJ Harvey, and Danger Mouse. He took his own life in Knoxville, Tennessee. Joel Rose has this appreciation.
Sparkle Horse was Mark Linkous. He wrote all the songs, played almost all of the instruments, and manipulated his voice like it was just another layer in the mix.
I started at first trying to disguise my voice because I didn't like it, but now I've gotten to really just use it as another instrument. It seems to make the proximity of a voice seem a lot closer to your ear.
What the Virginia native's voice was saying was often surreal, yet the music drew the attention of indie rock giants Radiohead, who invited Sparkle Horse to open for them in 1996. During the tour, Linkous overdosed on a cocktail of antidepressants and other drugs. He actually died for several minutes and suffered permanent damage to his legs. Still, Linkous' friend and collaborator Wayne Coyne from the band The Flaming Lips says that didn't stop him from recording and performing.
He was always gentle and always pleasant, but what made it more pronounced for me is that I knew he was in pain. I knew he struggled all the time. I knew he struggled to stand there and sing those gentle, crazy songs.
Coyne and Linkous worked together on Dark Night of the Soul, a music photography project involving Sparkle Horse, DJ Danger Mouse, filmmaker David Lynch, and others.
Pain. I guess it's a matter of sensation.
While Mark Linkous seemed happiest working on studio projects like this one, he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1999 that he also enjoyed performing before an audience.
When they really appreciate the slow songs, when you can get 500, 200, 2,000 people to be totally silent, and then they totally get it. And it's not just like a social situation where everyone's going out to drink and talk and socialize. They're really there to listen to what's going on.
Mark Linkous had almost finished a new album. He took his own life Saturday in Knoxville, Tennessee. He was 47 years old. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I am Netta Libby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
She comes with him.